Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. Almost flipped that around and showed you what it was. Anywho, we are still going through the North Carolina ratification debates, and I know, as I said yesterday and in a few other previous shows, there are a lot of things going on in the news cycle. You cannot allow yourself, even things that, man, this is going to be a big turn. Look at the magnitude of everything that's going on. Do you really believe that the audit of a state and turning over its election is going to get the end results? Now, what is the end results? What do we really need? Obviously, we need the federal government to comply to the Constitution so that they can't spend us into oblivion. They have no constitutional power or authority to bail out any state or to bail out from a disaster. They have no constitutional power or authority to put aside fuel reserves, energy reserves, or all sorts of these other types of things supposedly that are reserves. And the fact of the matter is, since they've had these reserves, many of them have been used in a manipulative form to help suppress inflation, to make a president look good, and those types of things. It's not like, you know, the first thing they do is they crack open the silage and send that silage down to where the people are being affected so that they have plenty of rice, corn, and those types of things that will, you know, sustain them. May not be the best, may not be filet mignon or truffles or what have you, but I am here to tell you that what we have to do is force the federal government into compliance if you want to solve the problems. There is not one event, not one, that's going along that's actually going to force the federal government into compliance. That will take action on your part. It will take action to get you and your local patriots to force your federal, or not force the federal government, force your local and state government to get into the mode of demanding full enforcement. It's that simple. Quit letting them chase the abortion rat. Quit letting them chase the immigration rat. I mean, there are things that you can do to help further the cause by using some of these fulcrums for leverage, but I'm just telling you, if you want to see the federal government into compliance, you've got to do something. And the only thing that you really need to know is what exactly is that thing. And I prove to you that it comes down to full compliance of the Constitution at every level of government. Now, so anyway, what we do want to do is we kind of want to let you know that we have our comment line, 425-270-5416. And more importantly, this show is also sponsored by RepublicReview.org. And this is, as I've always said, just said, this is the only show that gives you the academic evidence and the academic evidence-based solutions. So I guess what we can do is we can kind of move into the ratification base because we're still a good distance to go regarding the North Carolina debates. I'm going to say we've probably got a couple more episodes, but we'll see. But if I can focus and if I can get us to a point where we're actually there, then I honestly see that we're going to be in a much better situation than what we would find anywhere else. So anywho, let me just kind of get right to this. So this is where, now who we got talking? This is Mr. Iredell talking. And this is where Mr. Iredell was basically talking about jurisdiction. And so what he does is he says, I presume that in no state on the continent is a man tried on a criminal accusation by a trial by jury. It was necessary, therefore, that they should be fixed in the Constitution that the trial should be by jury in criminal cases. And such difficulties did not occur in this state as the other cases. The worthy gentleman says that by not providing for in civil cases it is expressly provided against. And what is that expressed given up? Were it so, no man would be more against the Constitution than myself. I should detest and oppose it as much as any man, but, sir, this cannot be the ease. I beg leave to say that the construction appears to me absurd and unnatural, the construction of the argument. As it could not be fixed either on the principles of uniformity or diversity, it must be left to Congress to modify it. If they establish any manner by law and find it inconvenient, they can alert it. But I am convinced that a majority of the representatives of the people will never attempt to establish a mode to their constituents as it will be in their best interest and take care of this right. But it is observed that there ought to be a fence provided against future encroachments of power. If there be not such a fence, it is a cause of objection. I readily agree that there ought to be such a fence. So he's kind of made a comment that Hamilton made with the Federalist Papers, that the state legislatures need to create barriers to ensure that the state government or the federal government doesn't encroach upon the powers of the state government. Moving on, he says this: the instrument ought to contain such a definition of authority as would leave no doubt, and that there be any ambiguity, it ought to be admitted. He says this construction is not agreeable to the people, though he acknowledges it is a right one. In my opinion, there is no man of any reason at all, but must be satisfied with so clear a plain definition if the Congress should claim any power not given them. I'm going to repeat that. If the Congress should claim any power not given them, it would be as bare a usurpation as making a king in America. If this Constitution be adopted, it must be presumed that the instrument will be in all hands of America, of every man in America, to see whether authority be usurped. And any person, by inspecting it, may see if the power claimed be enumerated, but if not be, he will know it will be a usurpation. Now, let's just point out that many, many men and women in America today don't have the Constitution. Well, the problem is because they don't understand it. It's too difficult. That's why, this is one of the primary reasons why I exist on this show, is to ensure that you can actually come here, you can download it, you can provide these without any worries from me. You can take any one of my shows and forward it to anybody. Cut out the promos. Make it so that they don't even know who the heck I am. You can do that, you know. Go get Nero Wave Editor, and that will really help you cut out any piece and part. And then you can send those things out and let people actually hear the solution, actually hear what the framer said about these encroachments, just like here and now, about this fence, that they need to create a fence. And I'm here to tell you that because you're doing this, because you're not entertaining, but educating and enlightening people on the truth of the Constitution, you're going to find out how much better off we all will be because of this education. Now, Mr. Iredell kind of steps into slavery, and actually, he doesn't respond to a person. What he's doing is he's responding to the fourth article, the first section of the clauses, and so forth. He says, I beg to leave to explain the reason of this clause. In some of the northern states, they have emancipated all their slaves. If any of our slaves, said he, go there and remain there a certain time, they would be, by present laws, be entitled to their freedom, so that their masters could not get them again. This would be extremely prejudicial, and the inhabitants of southern states, and to prevent it, this clause is inserted in the Constitution. Though the word slave is not mentioned, that is the meaning of it. The northern delegates owing to their particular scruples on the subject of slavery, did not choose to use the word slave be mentioned. So I guess they're being more transparent in the South and calling out the fact that what they were granted, this little appeasement, this little peace offering, and that's exactly what this is. But the truth be told, if you look at a state's rights, the Constitution can't, if just like the Constitution can't dictate that you have to have a slave state, the Constitution can't dictate that you can't be a sanctuary for anybody who's a slave and give them a path to freedom. We understand that slavery was a state issue, but by placing this one law in the Constitution, one would really, and one will quickly see that what we have is literally an opportunity for states to divine themselves and to go down this path of what I will call self-destiny and actually step up and say, hey, we're going to be a sanctuary for freedom. And that's supported by our Declaration of Independence and many of our founding documents. So anyway, as we're going into break, Mr. Iredell continues on, and we're going to do the due diligence and follow Mr. Iredell's following comments after this word slave be mentioned. And this is when they get into Article 5 and the amendment process. You'll love it. Excuse me, I got the hiccups or something. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me, AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let's kind of dive forward in what Mr. Iredell is saying after they read the fifth article, which is the amendment article process. And he says, Mr. Chairman, this is a very important clause. In every other constitution of government that I have ever or read of, no provision is made for necessary amendments. The misfortune attending most constitutions, which have been deliberately formed, has been that those who formed them thought their wisdom equal to all possible contingencies and that there could be no error in what they did. The gentleman who framed this constitution thought it was much more defendants of their capability, and undoubtedly, without a provision for amendment, it would have been more justly liable to objection, and the characters of its framers would have appeared much less meritorious. Anyway, this indeed is one of the greatest beauties of the system, and should strongly recommend it be to it very candid mind the constitution of any government which cannot be regularly amended when its defects are experienced reduces the people to this dilemma. They must either submit of its oppressions or bring about amendments more or less by a civil war. Happy this country we live in, the Constitution before us, if adopted, can be altered with as much regularity and as little confusion as any act of assembly. Now, I'm hoping you're getting the fact that what he's really spelling out here is that this Constitution may not have been perfect, or may have been kind of perfect. They still made a mode, a process in it, I'll use the word codified, a systematic, that's what codified means, a systematic process of how to change the Constitution without having to go through a civil war. And I'll say this, that there's also a codified process in dealing with breaches, and it has nothing to do with amendments. Again, as he goes on, he says, a little confusion, action is necessary, the most political, okay, so I'll just repeat this. Happy this, the country we live in, the Constitution before us, if it be adopted, can be altered with much regularity and as little confusion as any act of assembly. Not indeed quite so easily, which would be extremely impolitic. But if it is a most happy circumstance that there is a remedy in the system for its own failability, so that alterations can be made agreeable to the general sense of the people, let us attend to the manner in which amendments may be made. The proposition for amendments may arise from Congress itself when 2/3 of both houses shall deem it necessary. If they should not, now so here's the key right here. If Congress should not give you the amendments that you are seeking in fixing the Constitution, and yet amendments be generally wished by the people for the people, 2/3 of the state legislatures in different states may require a general convention for the purpose, in which case Congress are under the necessity of convening one. Okay? Any amendments which either Congress shall propose or which shall be proposed by such general convention are afterwards to be submitted to the legislatures of the different states or conventions called for that purpose, as Congress shall think proper, and upon the ratification of 3/4 of the states will become a part of the Constitution. By referring the business to the legislatures, expense would be saved, and in general, it may be presumed that would speak the genuine sense of the people. It may, however, on some occasions be better to consult an immediate delegation for that special purpose. This is, therefore, left discretionary. It is highly probable that amendments agreed to in either of these methods would be conducive to the public welfare, when so large a majority of the states consented to them, and in one of these modes, amendments are now wished for in a short time be made to this Constitution by the states adopting it. Now, if you read and you look at how the Convention of States is going down the path of requesting, they don't have an amendment out there. And here they're clearly saying that the only reason that you would convene a convention is because the Congress is not willing to give you the amendment that you have. How is that for clarity? How is that for a shot down, or a literally a clip, a knockout on the Convention of States, because here they're saying, well, we want to deal with all of these breaches. The reality is the Constitution's amendments and or convention process isn't about dealing with breaches. That's a completely separate process. It's about making changes to the Constitution, not dealing with breaches. Again, he goes on and says, it is, however, to be observed that the first and fourth clauses in the ninth section of the first article are protected from any alteration till the year of 1808. Now, he's pointing out in the very end of Article 5 that the first and fourth clauses in the ninth section of the first article are protected from any alteration. In other words, because they made this huge compromise of ending the slave trade 20 years down the road of the Constitution being established, then what he's pointing out is that within Article 5 of the Constitution, if by chance there is an effort by Congress or the state legislators that say, hey, we want to actually, you know, not do this slave trade thing, they can't. They can't do it because it is clear in Article 5, you cannot amend out and end this. That was the agreement, because Madison was clear, hey, you want to push this out 20 years, then we want a protection to ensure that in 20 years we will shut that down and you can't amend the Constitution to take that away. Interesting. This really shows good light for you on the issues of slavery and how the states were culpable in the problem, but more importantly, how the Constitution had this amendment protection clause at the end of Article 5 to keep the Constitution from doing that. If you also read that exact same amendment protection clause, there can be no change to a state's representation or suffrage in the Senate without that state's consent. So even though they may pass the 17th Amendment, which is that's exactly what they did, and what this is, that one part of Article 5's clause states, for some reason I'm tongue-tied today, but anyway, that means that no state will ever be denied its equal right of suffrage in the Senate unless they actually accept the amendment purported, such as the 17th Amendment. So this is why, and oh, by the way, amendments basically get closed as long as nobody ever revisits or opens them. Specifically, when somebody comes along and says, hey, we want to change this amendment, or we want to change our position on this amendment, like Delaware did with the 17th Amendment. I want you to be very clear that when they formally withdrew their rejection and formally ratified the Constitution, and the government allowed that to happen, the government just unlocked the door on the 17th Amendment to allow states that no longer want to ratify it to undo that and get the United States back to a point where we have 13 states that say, we don't want the 17th Amendment, and it goes bye-bye. It's that simple. Anyway, it is, however, this is Mr. Iredell again. It is, however, observed that the first and fourth clauses of the ninth section of the first article are protected from any alteration until the year 1808. And in order that no consolidation could take place, it is provided that no state, by any amendment or alteration, be deprived of equal suffrage in the Senate of its own consent. That's just what I just was telling you. And so, kind of really important, right? So, just letting you know that they actually cover a lot of these things in the ratification base, where you couldn't get that granularity and detail on what those things mean, and you'd go, oh, wise judge, tell us what this means. And they won't know, because they're not reading the ratification debates. Anyway, the first two prohibitions are with respect to the census, according to which direct taxes are imposed, and with respect to the importation of slaves. As to the first, it must be observed that there is a material difference between the northern and southern states. The northern states have been much longer settled and much fuller of people than the southern, but I have not land in equal proportion, nor scarcely any slaves. The subject of this article was regulated with great difficulty and by a spirit of concession, which it would not be prudent to disturb for any good many years. In 20 years, there will probably be a great alteration, that then the subject may be reconsidered with less difficulty and greater coolness. So anyway, insightful, right? Anyway, he's got a little bit more, and then Mr. Bass will pipe in, and we have a little more banter with Iridell, but we will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so moving on, this is what he says, because he was just talking about the considered less difficulty, 20 years from now, and possibly cooler heads. In the meantime, the compromise was upon the best footing that could be obtained. A compromise likewise took place in regard to the importation of slaves. It is probable that all the members reprobated this human traffic, but those of Southern Carolina and Georgia would not consent to an immediate prohibition of it. Interesting. He didn't include North Carolina. He didn't say us and our brethren, South Carolina and Georgia. He basically stated that it was driven. Now, in the convention, it was told that Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina moved over to basically approach the delegates of Virginia and tell them, hey, if you guys are going to make this about slavery and abolish our slavery, we're all leaving. So they were definitely there as moral support. One reason of this was that during the last war, they lost a vast number of Negroes, which loss they wished to supply. In the meantime, it is left to the states to admit or prohibit the importation, and Congress may impose limited duty upon it for that time being. Then Mr. Bass steps up and said, it was plain that the introduction of the amendments depended altogether on Congress. Amendments altogether depend on the states, not Congress. Congress can initiate and must initiate, but the states, almost every single amendment to the Constitution has been driven by the states. They didn't need to convene a convention. So anyway, Mr. Iredell says this, it was very evident that it did not depend on the will of Congress, for that the legislatures of two-thirds of the states were authorized to make application for calling a convention to propose amendments. And on such application, it is provided that Congress shall call such conventions so that they will leave no option. Now, I want you to understand. Here's the transparency. Here's full disclosure. That if the states call for a convention, Congress has the privilege of choosing the time and location. Well, if they put you in Hawaii, the states are going to be spending a very elaborate bill for sending their delegates to go to Hawaii. I just want you to understand, the states are on the hook for paying this bill. It's that simple. Anyway, here we go on supremacy. And so what they did was they just read the sixth article, the first clause, and they didn't have any observations, anybody, quip on the first clause. The second clause read, and that's where you find the supremacy clause, and we get a good discussion. This clause is supposed to give too much power when, in fact, it only provides for an execution of those powers which are already given in the foregoing articles. Now, to be clear, this is Mr. Iredell. What does it say? That, quote, this Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made, that's the wrong word. There's a typo here. It has raider under the authority, not raider. I believe it's under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any states to the contrary, notwithstanding, close quote. So Mr. Iredell provides a little more clarity. What is the meaning of this? But that as we have given power, we will support the execution of it. We should act like children to give power and deny the legality of executing it. It is saying no more than that. When we adopt the Constitution, we will maintain and obey it in the manner as if the Constitution of this state had said that when a law is passed in conformity to it, we must obey that law. Would this be objected to? Then when the Congress passes a law consistent with the Constitution, it is to be binding on the people. If Congress, under pretense of executing one power, should in fact usurp another, they will violate the Constitution. See, this is what I've been telling you. Anytime that the anti-federalists have come forward, they're going to do this. Every time they mention those things that they're going to do, they're blatant violations of the Constitution. Almost 99% of the time. I presume, therefore, that this explanation, which appears to me the plainest in the world, would be entirely satisfactory to the committee. Well, remember Mr. Bloodworth. Mr. Chairman, this is what Mr. Bloodworth says. Mr. Chairman, I confess his explanation is not satisfactory to me. I wish the gentleman had gone farther. I readily agree that it is giving them no more power than to execute their laws. Okay? So he agrees on the premise that the Supremacy Clause gives the federal government no more power other than to execute their laws. But how far does this go? It appears to me to sweep off all the constitutions of the states. It is a total repeal of every act and constitution of the states. The judges are sworn to uphold it. It will produce an abolition of state governments its sovereignty absolutely annihilates them. Now, Mr. Iredell responds, Mr. Chairman, every power delegated to Congress is to be executed by laws made for that purpose. It is necessary to particularize the powers intended to be given in the Constitution as having no existence before, but after having enumerated what we give up, it follows, of course, that what is done by virtue of that authority is legal under any new authority or power. The question, then, under this clause will always be whether Congress has exceeded its authority. If it has not exceeded it, we must obey, otherwise not. There you go. So here's the question. Everything that Congress has done in creating the Department of Education, the Department of Justice, have they exceeded their authority by taking up a power that is not within the enumerated powers? Absolutely they have. So we must not obey it, and otherwise, you know, we must actually take action. And this is where nullification and, more importantly, interposition comes into play. But we get into that after we go through the Constitution, or I should say the ratification debates. This Constitution, back to what Mr. Iredell says, this Constitution, when adopted, will become a part of our state Constitution. And the latter must yield to the former only in those cases where power is given by it. It is not to yield to it in any other case whatever. For instance, there is nothing in the Constitution of this state establishing the authority of a federal court, yet the federal court, when established, will be as constitutional as the Superior Court is now under our Constitution. It appears to me merely a general clause, the amount of which is that when they pass an act, if it be the execution of a power given by the Congress, it shall be binding on the people, otherwise not. As to the sufficiency or extent of the power, that is another consideration and has been discussed before. Now, Mr. Bloodworth comes up and says, this clause will be the destruction of every law which will come in competition with the laws of the United States. Those laws and regulations which have been, see, he's talking very ambiguously. There's very few powers when it comes to manufacturing, when it comes to homes, home standards, plumbing, when it comes to labor standards, they can't make any laws regarding those. And so Mr. Bloodworth apparently either is just dense and not getting it or is trying to be obstinate. Those laws and regulations which have been or shall be made in this state must be destroyed by it. If they come in competition with the powers of Congress, is it not necessary to define the extent of its operation? Is it not the force of our tender laws destroyed by it? The worthy gentleman from Wilmington has endeavored to obviate the object or the objection as to the Constitution's destroying the credit of our paper money and paying debts in coin. But unsatisfactorily to me, a man assigns by a legal action a bond to a man in another state. Could that bond be paid by money? I know it is very easy to be wrong. I am conscious of being frequently so. I endeavor to be open to conviction. This clause seems to me too general, and I think it is, to its extent, ought to be limited and defined, should suppose every reasonable man would think that some amendments to it were necessary. And so what I want to do now is let you know we've got McLean that's now as the Federalist who's going to respond. But I want you to understand that Mr. Bloodworth does not get the fact that here these men have been... I should say that the governments have been restrained, and the men or people of the government can't do things outside those enumerated powers. And when they do, they're illegal and illegitimate. We'll be right back after these two promos.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me put a different angle on this. What these anti-federalists keep on asserting is that these clauses, necessary and proper, supremacy clause and so forth, exclusive legislation, they don't look at it in context to the language of the clause, because each of these clauses point to these powers being general towards the enumerated powers, not all powers and not all general powers, but they give the general government all powers necessary for executing and or for performing the enumerated clauses within the Constitution, nothing more. It is not granting an open door for all clauses. This is why Madison, this debate, even though the Federalists won this debate, that these clauses are not that ambiguous. They bought off on the Federalist side, not the anti-Federalist side. Just to be clear, when Madison started talking in the, you know, the bounties for the cod fisheries, the vetoes for the Departments of Transportation, so forth and so on, in the rest of his career after this federal government, after this federal government has been created, Madison clearly points out consistently that these clauses only pertain to the enumerated clauses, not as portals of general power to the general government. Had that been the case, and had there been any Federalist saying, yep, you're right, these are going to grant them general powers so that they can go off and do these things. But because it was defined and these terms were clarified of what these clauses mean, these terms and definitions and clarifications are legally binding. They cannot do anything. These clauses, these supremacy clauses, so forth and so on, they can't provide the federal government any other new powers because they weren't defined that way. If they choose to define them, then this is where the state must step in and interpose and force the federal government into compliance. So Mr. McLean now does a follow-up with what Mr. Bloodworthy had just said. Bloodworth. If I keep on saying Bloodworthy, forgive me, it's Bloodworth. Mr. McLean. Mr. Chairman, that it will destroy the state's sovereignty is a very popular argument. I beg leave to have the attention of the committee. Government is formed for the happiness and prosperity of the people at large. The powers given it are for their own good. We have found by several years' experience that government taken by itself nominally without adequate power is not sufficient to promote the prosperity. Sufficient powers must be given to it. The powers to be given to the general government are proposed to be withdrawn from the authority of the state governments is in order to protect and secure the union at large. This proposal is made to the people. No man will deny their authority to delegate powers and recall them in all free countries, but says the gentleman last up, the construction of this Constitution is in the power of Congress and will destroy the sovereignty of the state governments. It may be justified, said, that it diminishes the power of the state legislatures, and the diminution is necessary to the safety and prosperity of the people. But it may be fairly said that the members of the general government, the president, senators, and representatives, whom we send thither by our free suffrages to consult our common interest, will not wish to destroy the state governments, but the existence of the general government will depend on that of the state governments. But what is the sovereignty and who is Congress? One branch, the people at large, the other branch, the states and the representatives. Do people fear the delegation of power to themselves, to their own representatives? But he objects that the laws of the Union are to be the supreme laws of the land. Is it not proper that their laws should be the laws of the land and paramount to those of any particular state? Or is it proper that the laws of any particular state should control the laws of the United States? Shall a part control the whole? To permit the local laws of any state to control the laws of the Union would be to give the general government no powers at all. If the judges are not to be bound by it, the powers of Congress will be nugatory. This is self-evident and plain. Bring it home to every understanding. It is so clear it will force itself upon it. The worthy gentleman says, in contradiction to what I have observed, that the clause which restrains the states from emitting paper money and etc. will operate upon the present circulating of paper money, and that gold and silver must pay paper contracts. The clause cannot possibly have a retrospective view. It cannot affect the existing currency in any manner except to enhance its value by the prohibition of future emissions or printing of money. It is contrary to the universal principles of jurisprudence that a law or constitution should have a retrospective operation, unless it be expressly provided that it shall. Does he deny the power of the legislature to fix a scale of depreciation as a criterion to regulate contracts made for depreciated money? As to the question he has put of an assigned bond, I answer that it can be paid with paper money. For this reason, the assignee can be in no better situation than the assigner. If it be regularly transferred, it will appear what person had the bond originally, and the present processor can recover nothing but what the original holder of it could. Another reason which may be urged is that the federal government courts could have no cognizance of such a suit. Those courts have no jurisdiction in cases of debt between the citizens of the same state. The assigner between a citizen of the same state with the debtor and the assignee, if it be to a citizen of another state, to avoid the intent of the Constitution, the assignee can derive no advantage from the assignment except with the assigner had a right to, and consequently the gentleman's objection falls to the ground. Every gentleman must see the necessity for the laws of the Union to be paramount to those of the separate states, and that the powers given by this Constitution must be executed. What shall we ratify a government and then say it shall not operate? Which is what they did with the AOC. This would be the same as not to ratify. As to the amendments, the best characters in the country and those whom I highly esteem wish for amendments, some part of it are not organized to my wish, but I apprehend no danger from the structure of the government. One gentleman, Mr. Bass, said he thought it neither necessary or proper for my part. I think it essential to be our existence as a nation and our happiness and prosperity as a free people. The men who composed it were men of great abilities and various minds. They carried their knowledge with them. It is the result not only of great wisdom and mutual reflection, but of, quote, mutual difference and concession. It has trifling faults, but they are not dangerous. Yet at the same time, I declare that if gentlemen propose amendments, if they be not such, and would destroy the government entirely, there is not a single member here more willing to agree to them than myself. Now, Mr. Davy then pipes in, and I got about a minute and a half, so I'm going to go ahead and read what I can of Mr. Davy's comments. Mr. Chairman, permit me, sir, to make a few observations on the operation of the clause so often mentioned. This Constitution has the powers therein granted is consistently to be the supreme law of the land. I'll repeat that. This Constitution, as the powers therein granted, is constantly to be the supreme law of the land. Every power ceded by it must be executed without being counteracted by the laws or constitutions of the individual states. Gentlemen should distinguish that it is not the supreme law in the exercise of power not granted. It shall be supreme only in the cases consistent with the powers specifically granted and not in usurpations. I mean, come on, how much more clear do you need this to be? Anyway, if you grant any power to the federal government, the laws made in pursuance of that power must be supreme and uncontrolled in their operation. This consequence is involved in the very nature and necessity of the thing. The only rational inquiry is whether those powers are necessary and whether they are properly granted. To say that you have vested the federal government with power to legislate for the Union and then deny the supremacy of the laws is a soulless in terms. With respect to its operation on our own paper money, I believe a little consideration will satisfy every man that it cannot have the effect asserted by the gentleman from New Hanover. Now we're going to kind of pause right there, and we'll be back with the rest of this statement and more of the North Carolina debates. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL. Or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing.